Hello, and welcome to State of Crime, the Apocalypse Edition. Yay! Or the Plague Edition, or I don't know. It's got to be some sort of a special edition. Even though we'd had our 100th episode last week, and now we all get to practice extreme social distancing and stay home and listen to our favorite podcasts and read books and watch movies and all the good stuff. So
this is a great time for introverts who hate people.
Honestly, my life has changed very, very little.
Right.
Yeah. Like I said, the only thing I do worry about my mom, that has been a worry. I don't like students coming up and touching me right now. They all want to hug me. And I'm just like, please don't, please don't, please don't. But other than that, yeah.
Yeah, not a whole lot's changed.
Not a whole lot. And I have always hoarded toilet paper. I think I've mentioned that before.
I think you have.
Yeah, on here. And so.
Because that's something I've known for a long time. Yeah. You always have a shit ton of toilet paper.
I do. I do. Ha ha. Good choice of words. yeah, this is my moment, apparently. So, but I do have to say, like, one thing I've been thinking about a lot, and you and I were talking about before we started recording a bit, is I really, really hope that people take all the things that they're finding out and pointing out about society right now that is making this time harder for people and work like hell to make it better once this passes.
Which is probably not going to happen.
I know, but I've, because honestly, we don't, like I said, we don't realize how easy we're really getting off with this, because my prediction, and I'm not a doctor or anything, but my prediction is once we do get into calmer waters with this, we are going to find out that in the end, the death rate for this is probably going to be very analogous to the flu.
Right.
And it's tragic. I understand for people who are dying. I don't want to sound like I'm lessening that. But can you imagine if this were something that had a death rate like the Black Death or Ebola,
right,
or even H1N1? You know, the thing is, people are focusing so much on numbers. And, you know, like some of my students were like, well, you know, the normal flu has killed more people than this. And I'm like, well, by that argument, so has Ebola. You know what I mean? Like, the flu's killed more people than Ebola. So do you not worry about catching Ebola? And, you know, they're like, what? And I'm like, that's not how you figure out how dangerous a disease is. You figure out how dangerous it is by its mortality rate. And you figure out mortality rates by taking the total number of people who get infected and what percentage of them die. And that is something that, like, every time we talk about the numbers of deaths, I feel like the media, anybody doing the reporting, should immediately say, and that is, you know, 2.5% of the total people who get it. So people really understand what mortality rates are,
right,
and how deadly these varying diseases truly are. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because people be stupid.
Right.
As we're finding out with toilet paper.
Right. Like, we are currently on a toilet paper shortage.
Yeah.
And when, like, I still to this day, I don't understand why toilet paper. There's so many other things that you should be stockpiling in this time. If you're going to be stockpiling stuff, why toilet paper?
Well, I just feel like, you know, people think, well, if I'm home, you know, that's one thing I don't want to run out of. I think we've all run out of toilet paper at one point in our lives, and we know how awful it is. That's another reason. But honestly, at its base, you know, people have this innate drive to do something. You know, whenever anything happens, you immediately hear people screaming about somebody should do something, and then they try to find things to do. And it's a way of trying to assert control. And people do whatever they can to assert control in these situations. And, you know, like I, you know, we were talking, and I really am feeling my age right now. Not just because in some of the things I've seen out there, people over 50 need to be worried, although most of them, it's over 60 or above. But the fact that I was, and this is, might be, part of it is my mom growing up in post-World War II Germany and suffering the privations that she did as a kid. Some of it is my Mormon background, my LDS background, where an inherent part of the LDS religion has always been that you have a year's stockpile of food and necessities, or as close to that as you can financially afford. And so I've just always grown up that when you have a little extra money, you buy food, you know, and you stock your pantry and your freezer, and then you rotate that in.
Right.
And you constantly have stuff on supply, you know, on hand just in case.
Yeah.
Because even if you get a bad flu or something, do you know what I mean? And you're stuck at home for a while, you want to have these things on hand. You don't want to have to always go out to the stores. And so, yeah, it's an interesting time we're living in. I wrote down a few notes, too, about this. First of all, and I'm sure there's some out there, but I spend a lot of time on social media. Mm-hmm. I have yet to see anybody singing My Corona to the tune of My Sharona.
I have actually, that's so funny, because anytime
that I was disappointed.
I think I might have seen one or two on TikTok, but, and maybe it was just me that had it like playing in my head,
yeah.
But like I had the same thought.
Me too.
Cool.
Yeah. And I don't have TikTok. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
It's an obsession. It's a rough one.
I did want to recommend two TED Talks because I felt like these two were very, very informative for me individually. I showed them to my students. The first one, I really wish it had a different title because the title sounds very alarmist. And while the talk definitely is trying to get us to think logically and clearly about things, it's not trying to induce panic. So the two TED Talks, if you go on YouTube and you Google this, you'll find it, is Coronavirus is Our Future. Okay. And it was given, like, I think in the past week or 2 weeks. It's excellent. It's given by a woman epidemiologist. She lays everything out so clearly. She gives very good advice on what you can do. It's brilliant. And then the other one is all the way back from 2015, and it's Bill Gates, The Next Outbreak, We're Not Ready. And he, in that talk, focuses more on Ebola, which, you know, has a much, much higher mortality rate than what we're currently dealing with. But watch it. It's fascinating. And then start voting appropriately, people. You know, do understand that, you know, our pandemic team here in the United States was fired in 2018 and never replaced, as supposedly is, I don't know, a money cutting thing. But, you know, you need to start voting for politicians who think scientifically. I'm sorry, but you do. And I don't care what side of the aisle you fall on. You have to start making science a part of your decision making, or we are all going to die. And the other thing is I want to talk a little bit about, cause this is driving me crazy, flattening the curve. So this has been a lot on social media as well that people need to think about. Now, somebody like you who's young and healthy and everything, if you only hang around other young and healthy people, great.
Right.
Go out, do whatever you want to do, run around. I don't care. Lick a pole, whatever makes you happy. If you have any contact with anyone who is immunocompromised in any way, whether they're elderly, if they have diabetes, if they are on certain medications, there are some very good graphs out there that you can look at, then you need to practice flattening the curve. Like I said, I'm not so worried about me per se catching it. I'm scared to death about me having it and bringing it home to my mother,
right?
Whether I'm symptomatic or not. You know, and the fact that people don't, there was some idiot who's running for school board, ironically enough, down in Nevada, who was bragging that she's 30 years old, so she went to Red Robin and she just ate her meal as long as she wanted because this is America and no one can tell her what to do with her life. And it's like, look, it's not about you catching it, you idiot. It's about all the other people that you are going to have contact with.
Right.
And we don't know exactly how long an incubation period this thing has. We do know it's at least several days, maybe even longer.
Right.
I've seen some reports out there as much as 24 days. You know, and that's what is, you're the one who's the most dangerous, are the people who have it, are carrying it and don't know they have it because you're spreading it everywhere. So, anyway.
Just wash your hands, guys.
Wash your hands. You know, avoid crowds. There's good logical information out there. So, and like I said, my hope is that we learn some things from this, which, what was your response when I said that?
Not going to happen.
I know. But I hope. Oh, I'm coughing. seriously, I woke up with a headache this morning and I immediately panicked. But I'm really hoping that we'll learn to strengthen our communities and do better by people. Humans need each other. We need to do better, you know, and this idea that you can just go out and hoard everything for yourself is never going to work. Mm-mm. So we have to know that. And I was really thinking, I think I mentioned that I recently made the mistake of introducing Liam to Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. It's a Broadway show. And of course, Liam immediately demanded I buy him a multicolor coat so that Dante will know that he is the favorite child. That's what he took away from that. Jesus. So yeah, because, you know, my kids are great. But I was thinking about that whole story the whole Joseph story where, you know, when Pharaoh has his dream about, you know, the seven fat cows and then the seven skinny cows come out of the Nile and eat up the seven fat cows. And then he sees the same thing with seven ears of corn that are beautiful and perfect, and then seven nasty, blasted, diseased ears of corn eat them up. And so Joseph's like, oh, that means we're gonna have 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And so they immediately institute a food storage program that during the 7 years of plenty, they're going to store everything, and they do it as a community. That's the biggie. You know, that's my problem with shows like Preppers and a lot of these doomsday prep kind of things is it's this idea, I'm going to get it all for myself and screw you people. You know what I mean? Right. But if we approach these things communally and think about them, we do much better.
Right.
So that's my 2 cents. So, yeah. I'm also seeing an explosion in food storage classes after this. You're going to see people offering all kinds of things. It's going to take off. So, and like I said, I'm very grateful for my background in hoarding toilet paper.
Right.
And this is my time to shine, people.
It's funny.
Please don't come kill me for my toilet paper.
So we are actually doing a case today.
We
just had a little bit of a chit-chat. We could not talk about it.
No, because everybody's talking about it. How do you not talk about it right now? Right. So, yeah. So we are actually getting back on track.
Right.
Where we're doing one state, two murders, lots of crime. even though this is still the apocalypse edition. But we are traveling to the state of Connecticut, which a lot of people I don't think associate with a lot of murders. Connecticut is known for has a lot of wealthy people. It's right. One of those states that, you know, statistically per capita, there's a lot of money there. And the case that we're covering here has lots of money, has a very famous family connection because we've got people who are related to the Kennedys here. So this is different for me because it's a case that is pretty famous, although you said you...
By name, don't know.
By name, you don't know it. We'll you might see. When I get into it. It's also technically a cold case.
Which is very strange for you because you hate them.
I know. Although, again, even that part of this is kind of shady, mainly because of who's involved.
Okay.
So we're going to Connecticut to talk about the murder of 15-year-old Martha Moxley. Dun, and you're dun, just dun. Dun, dun, dun. So we're going to the community. Actually, I forgot to write this down. I apologize. But we're going to be talking about basically Greenwich, Connecticut.
Okay.
And Greenwich, Connecticut, like I said, in 1975 was the home of many wealthy families. Today, it's still the home of many wealthy families. Anyway, so there's a lot of money here. Although, like I said, the actual little enclave here, there's another name, and I apologize for not remembering it. So the Kennedy connection comes in here with the Skakel family. So the Skakel family lived here in Greenwich, And the way that they had a Kennedy connection through their mother.
Okay.
Okay, that's why the names are different. But their mom, the mother of the Skakel family, had died quite young. And so despite their wealth and their famous family connections, the Skakels were known for being kind of wild around town. Despite their wealth, they were often left unattended. They just kind of did whatever they want. I think a lot of those stereotypes we have about rich frat boys, you know, rich white frat boys, mm-hmm. you could probably apply to the Skakels, okay? So Martha, as we said, was, I mean, if you look at pictures of her, she had long blonde hair. She looks like your typical 1975 teenager, had a nice family. And she lived basically next door, although next door might be a little bit misleading because these houses have huge yards. Right. You know what I mean? So there's some distance between them. But so Martha had long been friends with Tommy and Michael Skakel.
Okay.
The two boys here. And things, so she, about a month before the crime happens, before she's murdered, she had written in her diary, "I need to stop talking to Michael because every time I talk to Tommy, he thinks I have a thing for Tommy." So there was apparently at least some sort of perceived love triangle with Martha and Tommy and Michael Skakel. At the very least, in Michael Skakel's eyes.
Right.
Now, how legit some of this stuff was, it's hard to say.
Right.
So we're going to go right to the murder. So on October 30th, 1975, and I'm taking this off of a really detailed PDF that I found online. There's some really good timelines of this case. Okay. So, and there are, if you go on YouTube, there's a lot of documentaries. Like I said, this case is really been heavily covered. I think A, because as we've talked about, you know, beautiful, blonde, rich girls, when they get murdered, it gets a lot of attention.
Right.
You have the Kennedy family connection here, and everybody likes to talk about Kennedy curses and Kennedy tragedies. So that pulls this in. Like the O.J. Simpson case, justice can be bought, maybe. You know, there's a little bit maybe of that in here. And so, yeah, we'll go on. So on October 30th, Martha and some friends, so this is the night before Halloween, and a lot of people know that in some places you have a tradition of mischief night, okay. or as the crow called it, devil's night, which is common in some place. So Martha and some friends went out for an evening of these mischief night pranks before they stopped at the home of Tommy and Michael Skakel. And basically, it sounds like the Skakel home was where the teenagers in the neighborhood went a lot because, as we said, they weren't supervised.
Right.
So, now, Martha's family, although she was allowed to socialize with the Skakels and things like that, she had strict rules and she was supposed to be home at 10 p.m.
Okay.
She never comes home. And again, wealthy community, the police immediately start searching for her. As does Martha's family, neighbors, everybody immediately gets on this. This isn't one of those cases of, oh, she's a runaway or, you know,
good.
That kind of
as
nonsense.
As none should be.
Right.
Well, most.
Yes. And of course, Dorothy, her mother, stays up all night. They search all night. They don't find anything. The Greenwich police do start saying, well, maybe she ran away. So it does enter the conversation, but at least they're trying to find her.
Right.
At 4 a.m., they search nearby Bellhaven. 6 a.m., John Moxley, the father, returns home from searching for his daughter. And at 10 a.m., Dorothy Moxley goes over to the Skakel home to look for Martha, and she speaks to Michael. And then at 12:15 p.m. on October 31st, Martha's friend, also 15 years old, her name is Sheila McGuire, is walking through the Moxley's backyard. And like we said, these yards are huge. So right. This isn't that unusual that they wouldn't have seen her. She finds her friend dead under a pine tree. And this had been a brutal crime. Martha had been beaten savagely with that golf club. Her head was literally bashed in until the golf club broke in half. And then they had used the broken half to stab her in the neck. The golf club belongs to a set that was owned by the Skakel family. But supposedly the golf clubs had just been thrown all around the yard anyway. So, in other words, it would have been easy enough for somebody just to pick one up as a weapon of opportunity. Right. And then, so the police arrive, they have a mobile crime scene set up, and, you know, like I said, these people have the benefit of wealth.
Right.
So the crime scene for 1975 seems to be handled pretty well. Martha's body is not even moved until 5:30 p.m. when she's taken to Greenwich Hospital. Tommy Skakel, who is older than Michael, is taken to the Greenwich Police Station for questioning. He doesn't return home till 10:30. On November 1st, 1975, so the very next day, Dr. Elliot Gross conducts an autopsy and comes to the conclusion that, yes, this golf club is the cause of her death. And the next day, November 2nd, Greenwich detectives remove a set of golf clubs matching the murder weapon from the Skakel home. Now, again, I don't know if they had been repicked up, because like I said, one of the sources I looked at said that the golf clubs had just kind of been everywhere. You know? Right,
they were just scattered.
Yeah, that they were scattered. So I'm not sure about this. On November 3rd, Tommy Skakel is given a polygraph test. The results are inconclusive. November 4th, Martha is buried, and over 500 people attend her funeral.
Damn.
And of course, you know, there's onlookers and media everywhere, which is really sad. You know what I mean? Like, again, I sometimes feel guilty about podcasting about some of this stuff. Right. Do you know what I mean? Because, yeah. But anyway, on November 9th, Tommy Skakel is given a second polygraph test. This time he supposedly passes. And so there are several people who they continue to question. Numerous polygraph tests are given and all of this kind of stuff. And this is when things start to get a little more heated up. So at first it seems like the police really did focus much more on Tommy Skakel,
okay,
the older brother. And he's given psychological exams. You know, the detectives take his school records. They investigate all of those. And things continue on. So I'm going to jump to another timeline here. Give me just a second while I do that, please. And we'll go and talk about some more of these things. But, okay. Sorry about that. So I want to jump back to the murder for just a second. And I apologize, but I put together two timelines here, so I'm jumping just ahead. One of the things I want to talk about, so when Martha was found, she was 50 yards from her home, okay?
Okay.
And she was still within her own backyard, so I want to point that out. As we said, she'd been bludgeoned and stabbed with the golf club. The head of the golf club was lying next to her family's driveway. The rest of the club was never found. So, I didn't point that out.
Sketchy.
Yes. Her pants and underwear had been pulled down past her knees, but there were no signs of rape or sexual assault.
That's weird.
Yeah. And based on the liver temperature that they did, she died between 9:45 and 10 p.m. the previous night, which all of that makes me think, she was probably walking home.
Right.
Right. And got attacked. Okay. And it was on this timeline that they said the clubs had been tossed throughout the Skakel's yard and could have been picked up by anyone.
Right.
Now, this timeline says that both Michael and his older brother Thomas were both questioned on October 31st. Michael said he and Thomas had both seen Martha the night before. And then based on the timeline, Thomas was the last person to see her before she died. And we know how that often works out, right? Thomas told police that he and Michael, along with two other friends, had sat in a car with Martha in their driveway from 9 to 9:30 p.m. And then their older brothers had made them leave because they needed to give their cousin a ride home.
Okay.
Thomas said that the two friends and Michael left, and he spoke with Martha for a few minutes before she left too. And by the way, I want to give credit to this timeline. I'm pulling this from an article written by Lisa Marie Fuqua. And I'm sorry, I'll get the name of, and it's from medium.com, because I am just pulling a lot of this straight off, and I don't want to plagiarize here. So sorry about that. Thomas said that he then went inside, and after he talked to her for a few minutes and she left for home, that he went inside to work on a school report about Abraham Lincoln. And when investigators followed up with his teachers, none of them had assigned him such a report. So, you know, it seems weird. Why would you say you were working on a report about Abraham Lincoln? Michael, the younger brother, and those of you who are familiar with this case, every time I say Michael, you're perking up, corroborated the first part of his brother's story. He said he had been in the car with the others, but he claimed he had left with his brothers, so the car belonged to the older Skakel brothers, to give his cousin a ride home, and that he wasn't there when Martha left. Now, another name that gets thrown around besides Thomas and Michael Skakel in this case is a 24-year-old named Kenneth Littleton. He had moved into the Skakel house the day that Martha died. He was hired there as a tutor. He claimed he was inside the house watching The French Connection, an old movie, see it if you haven't, and that the housekeeper, Mrs. Watson, could corroborate this. He claims, this Kenneth Littleton, the tutor, claims that at 9:45, Mrs. Watson, the housekeeper, came to him saying she had heard noises outside her window and asked him to check it out. Before going out to look, he went to check on the Skakel brothers, and none of the four were at home.
None of them.
None of them. He went outside, did not hear or see anyone. He went back inside, continued to watch TV, and according to Littleton, Thomas was the first brother to return home at 10:25 p.m. And he then sat down with Littleton to watch the movie, and then the other three brothers, Rush Jr., John, and Michael, returned home about half an hour later.
And her time of death was between 9:45 and 10?
Yes. According to the liver temperature.
Right.
Now, you know, how much leeway, do we have here? I don't know.
Right.
So at that time, Thomas seemed to have the most unaccounted time by himself. And that's why initially he is the focus of the police investigation. So that's that. The police continue going back to the Skakel family, having them go over their timelines again and again. And finally, the family is like, okay, we're done talking to you. You know, we're over this. And their attorneys, as attorneys so often do, suggested stop talking to the police.
Right.
Okay. So by July of 1976, so we've gone from October 75. Mm-hmm. So we are, what, about 8-9 months right. out? Kenneth Littleton had been fired by the Skakel family and had moved to Nantucket, Massachusetts. While he was there, he was arrested for burglary and theft. And while he was being arrested in custody for that, they questioned, the police questioned him about the murder of Martha Moxley, and he took a polygraph test, which he failed. So,
see, polygraphs are so hard because when it's like, we tell you don't take a polygraph test no matter what.
Right.
Because they're not admissible in court. They're not a science. They're not 100% accurate. Like, just don't do it.
Right.
But then when we do have people who take a polygraph test and they pass, they're like, oh, they're fine because they passed the polygraph test. Or if they fail, then we're like, aha.
Well, and just so you know, like Dorothy Moxley, Martha's mother, also took a polygraph test. She failed.
Well, yeah, she just lost her daughter.
Exactly. And that's the thing. It registers your emotional upset more than anything else. What are you emotionally upset about? That's the trick.
Right.
So, and so at this point, police believe that either Kenneth Littleton or Thomas Skakel are their most likely suspects, but they never have enough evidence to charge either one of them. The case goes cold. Now, we're up to 1978. Michael Skakel is arrested for driving drunk. And in order to avoid jail time, again, he's a rich boy, right? Mm-hmm. So he gets to do these things. He makes a deal to enroll at the Elan School in Poland Spring, Maine, to get treatment for his alcohol addiction. Now, this is where the case took a huge turn. And this is where things got very controversial.
Okay.
While he's at that Elon school, a roommate claims that he heard Michael Skakel confess to the whole crime. And he claims that Michael told him that he beat Martha with a golf club because she rejected him. Which we have that little hint in her diary, right, from a month before her death. And supposedly, he added, I'm going to get away with murder. I'm a Kennedy. Now, if you're wondering, why wasn't anything done?
Because he's a rich white boy.
Well, and the person, the witness, never contacted anybody until 1996.
Jesus Christ.
Which is, what, 18 years later?
Right.
And when he did contact somebody, it was a news station. So not the police, right? But a news station.
Well, and I also feel like 18 years later, how...
Now, so I'm going to go on to. After that story broke, other people who also attended the Elon school come forward and say they also heard him confess. And I know that one of the confessions supposedly took place, at least one, in a 12-step group meeting. And I don't know what you guys know about Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know.
I mean, it's in the name.
Right.
Anonymous.
Exactly. And so there is this idea that, you know, things are supposed to, you know, whatever you confess within. It's like Vegas, you know, right. What happens there stays there.
Right.
So, yeah, not good. 5 years prior to these witnesses coming forward in 1991, forensic pathologist Dr. Henry Lee, who, if you've been a long-time crime junkie, you know this name because he was a superstar in the 90s and the early 2000s, probably still is. I mean, he was brought in lots and lots of high-profile cases. I think he might even have been on the OJ case. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah,
but I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's brought in to re-examine evidence. Now, at the time of the murder, investigators had collected clothes that they found in the Skakel's garage. They were pants and shoes that they believed belonged to Michael. They had blonde hairs on them, thought to be Martha's. The pants also contained hair strands that belonged to a male Caucasian they could never place. The hairs they thought appeared to be Martha's turned out to not match, so they weren't hers.
Also, Henry Lee was involved in the O.J. Simpson trial.
Woohoo! Good memory, Elena. Big brain. Dr. Lee reviewed the photographs and determined that the killing was sexually motivated because of the blood smears on her body. Now,
that's weird because there wasn't sign of any sexual assault.
No, but I think maybe she was touched. After? I don't know. Because like I said, you know, somebody pulled down her pants and panties, and they did that after
Right.
She was attacked. So Dr. Henry Lee also said that because there were no defense wounds on her. And he said that's because she knew her attacker. The attacker was enraged with her. And I'm going to assume, you know, he also is that maybe the killer snuck up beside her in the dark and hits her over the head.
And
she doesn't even have a chance. Right. You know, and after the initial blow, it was so hard that if it didn't knock her unconscious, it at least dazed her.
Right.
You know, and apparently from Dr. Lee's things, she was stabbed more than once. And again, because this article says she would have been at least dazed while he continued beating and stabbing her with that broken handle. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you know, the other thing I read, it just said she was stabbed. So I don't know how many times she was stabbed.
Right.
So I should have looked that up. So after all of this breaks, Rushton Skakel, who is Michael's father, hires a private investigator to look into the case. Obviously, he believes his sons are innocent. He wants to clear their names. And it's during this process, the boys again meet with an investigator, and both of them change their stories from 16 years prior in 1975. So we're still in 1991 here.
Right.
This is 5 years before all that other stuff breaks, okay? So in 1991, Thomas opens up and admits he lied to the police. He now says he had gone into the house around 9:30 p.m., as he said before, but that he went back outside after that to talk to Martha some more. And he says that during the second time he spoke with her, they engaged in a consensual sexual act. Then he claims he'd gone inside for the night around 9:50. Thomas said he lied to the police, obviously, because he was scared. You know,
right.
How would this look? Okay. The problem here, according to the Medium article, is that at 1 a.m. that night of her disappearance, Martha's mother, Dorothy, had called the Skakel house looking for her daughter, right? Because remember, she stays up all night. Her husband's looking for her.
Right.
You know, they've got the police, everything. On that night, Thomas said he had last seen Martha at 9:30. And why would he lie?
Right.
If he didn't know she was dead yet?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think the only other possible explanation for him lying is that, like, he knew that she had to be home at 10, mm-hmm. and he knows that he left her at 9:50, and he's just, at that point, if he didn't know she was dead, he's just trying to save her ass from, like, oh, I don't know, she left here going home.
Right.
At 9:30.
Yes.
That's the only other option, aside from him, you know.
Right.
That's the only logical reason for him to lie, not knowing
or
she was dead.
Or
he killed her.
Or he knew his brother did.
Right.
Or whoever, right?
Right. He was covering for somebody.
Right. And here's the thing, because Thomas changes his story and so does Michael. And the fact that both of them change, do you know what I
mm-hmm.
mean? Whichever one of them may or may not be the murderer, they probably know who is.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So Michael claims his change is that he had seen Martha in the car, that he left with his two older brothers to give his cousin a ride home. But again, his change is that around midnight, he went back outside. That he walked over to Martha's house. He climbed up a tree outside her bedroom. He threw rocks at her window to try to wake her up, but he never came to the window, so he went back home. Some claim that if this story is actually true, he would have seen her body in the yard.
That was my thought, was what, you just walked right past
uh-huh.
her dead body?
But people also said, depending on the path that he took from his home to hers and back, he could have missed it. And Michael does admit he thought he heard something or someone that night while out, but he didn't see anyone. And I have also heard claims, and I don't know if it's this instance, but I remember watching a documentary years ago when this case was heating back up, where he also claimed, and I don't know if it was this particular night or if he had done it on other nights, that he would sometimes climb in that tree and watch her through a window and masturbate in the tree. So there's that. Hmm. 1998, so a couple years after all of this heats back up,
right,
where people are saying, hey, Michael confessed to it. Two true crime books, one called Green Town by Timothy Dumas, and you're going to love this one because we've got another connection to the OJ case. Mark Furman writes a book called Murder in Greenwich. And by the way, Mark Furman believes Michael Skakel did it. June 1998, there is an 18-month, one-person grand jury review of information gathered by investigators. 2000, an arrest warrant is issued for unnamed individuals in Martha Moxley's murder. Later that day, Michael Skakel surrenders to police, but is later released on a $500,000 bond. Okay. And again, on June 21st, 2000, at a pretrial hearing, two former classmates from the Elon School testify that Michael Skakel confessed to them back in the 70s. And again, they repeat this, I'm going to get away with murder, I'm a Kennedy. And so on May 7th of 2002, testimony begins in the murder trial of Martha Moxley 27 years after her death.
But you said it was a cold case.
Well.
So what happened during trial?
On June 7th, 2002... Michael Skakel is convicted, and on August 29th, he's sentenced to 20 years to life in prison. Immediately in November 24th, 2003, his lawyers file an appeal to overturn the murder conviction.
And it got overturned, didn't it?
So this goes on for a very long time, and I'm just going to abbreviate things here to because it's crazy. So he was convicted in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
His case ends up getting overturned in 2013. However, the murder conviction is reinstated in 2016.
Wait, what?
And then gets overturned again in 2018.
What the fuck is happening?
So, yeah, right now, Michael Skakel is free. And
how does that happen?
So
Legally, how does that happen?
Well, what happens is, so let me go jump back here. Sorry. I'm sorry. My voice is froggy. So December 30th, 2016, the Connecticut. I need to go back. Don't I?
Please.
Yes. So sorry. I'm going back to the 2013 thing. So on October 23rd, 2013, his defense attorney, Mickey Sherman, was considered constitutionally deficient. In other words, he didn't, you know, defend him as well as he should have.
Okay.
And so a Connecticut appellate judge orders a new trial to be set for Skakel.
Okay.
On November 21st of 2013, he's released on bond, but there are lots of conditions, like he can't leave Connecticut, he had to wear a GPS tracking device, and he had to report to a bail commissioner. So basically, it was like being on, you know, on a parole, right, in a lot of ways. August 8th, 2014, prosecutors filed an appeal to reinstate Skakel's conviction. And so on December 30th, 2016, the Connecticut Supreme Court reinstated Skakel's guilty conviction from 2002 in a 4-3 decision.
What the fuck?
So that threw out the appellate court's order of a new trial. So, okay. So we've gone up to the Connecticut Supreme Court at this point. January 6, 2017, Skakel's attorneys filed a motion asking for a 7-member court panel to hear their motion to reconsider the Connecticut Supreme Court ruling. And on May 4th, 2018, the Connecticut Supreme Court vacates Skakel's conviction, which leaves it open that he can be retried in the future. It's not, he's not like on, he doesn't get double jeopardy or anything like that. It's just a way of saying, okay, it's kind of almost like saying this was a mistrial, I guess. You know what I mean? Jesus Christ. I know. It's very frustrating. And the last date that we have there is January 7th, 2019.
Okay.
The U.S. Supreme Court denied Connecticut's petition, which they had filed to have the vacated conviction undone. The conviction is considered vacated without any further options other than for the state to retry him. So
if they're going to do anything, they have to retry him.
Yeah.
That's a shit show.
Yes. And you will still find people out there who argue that it wasn't Michael who killed her, it was Thomas or it was Kenneth Littleton. Those three seem to have the most suspicion swirling around them. It's a hard, hard case. And I have to tell you, I'm not 100% sure. Pretty sure it was one of the Skakel brothers.
Right.
I do have to say that just based on, and I've watched a lot of documentaries about this. I believe that shortly after this 2018 ruling, her brother, Martha Moxley's brother, was interviewed on Fox News. And I believe that he stated that he sat, of course, through all the trial. He felt like Michael was guilty. You know, and again, when you get into this and if you do a little bit more research, both Thomas and Michael had been in trouble a lot, but Michael in particular seemed to have kind of a hair trigger temper and some of those, you know, rather alarming, you know, things that we associate with somebody who would flip out and beat somebody to death with a
golf club.
You know, and then part of the issue here is I believe Thomas was already 18, but Michael was like 15, 16. He was close, very close to Martha. So he was a minor when this happened.
Yeah.
He was a minor when he was sent to that school. So that is also a mitigating factor here.
Right.
But this is just a sad, sad case.
That was a shit show.
I thought you would feel that way.
Yeah, that fucking...
And like I said, it's weird because it's cold case, but to me it's really not a cold case. Yeah.
Right, that's weird.
And again, if you have enough money and enough lawyers and you can keep these things going, you know, I thought it tied, not aside from Mark Furman being obsessed with this case... And Dr. Henry Lee is like the coronavirus. He's everywhere. and he's involved in all kinds of cases. But so there's some interesting parallels there too, I thought. So
I'm kind of nervous to have to do my Connecticut case.
Do you have it picked out?
No.
Oh. There's some good ones.
Is there?
So, mm-hmm. Okay,
we'll see what
I think you'll find some good ones. So.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Anyway, so people, unless you are a young, healthy person who only interacts with other young, healthy people, you know, take it easy the next few weeks. Be sane. Avoid crowds. Do your part. Do some research. Educate yourself. Stay well.
Keep looking at our Facebook page and our Facebook discussion group because we will soon be doing a giveaway.
Woohoo!
Wait, yeah, we're excited about that. We still have some kinks to work out on what we're going to do and stuff
that.
But
and we know that nobody can afford to buy merch right now because everybody spent all their money on toilet paper. But you know, when things pick up, maybe buy some merch. Yeah. And is there anything else?
Check out our Instagram.
All the good stuff we always say at the end of the, you know the routine.
It's been like an emotionally exhausting day.
Yeah, poor Kaylin's not doing. I had to yell at her to get off her phone earlier while I was doing my case. Just
you're
so you
always
know.
On your phone when I'm doing cases.
But I at least interact. You were just sitting there like a lump on a log.
Whatever. It's been a rough day.
Yeah, Kaylin had a rough day, so we love her. Send her some good vibes. Send me some good vibes.
I think I'm going to go take a nap.
Okay, go take a nap. All of us should be taking naps.
I agree.
That's right. And
it's Sunday. Take a nap.
Practice the art of hygge at these difficult times. We love you. We're sending positive vibes to you. Oh, And while you are home, you know, make sure you check out our friend Amber Jones and her Professionally Silly podcast and YouTube channel. They're a delightful way to pass the time. Mm-hmm. They will give you a laugh at these difficult times. Check out, go to Amazon and check out, look, just do a search for Jeff Wade. He has a great book about a possible conspiracy with Confederate gold right here in Idaho. That's a fascinating read. And, you know.
And then there's always stateofcrimepodcast.com.
There you go. And just reconnect.
You know, you can't go out and go shopping, so do all your shopping online.
Yeah, there you go.
Stateofcrimepodcast.com, man. Yeah. All right. Till next week.
See you next time.
Bye.